From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. California is facing a big shortage in primary care physicians. It's driven by the expansion of Medi-Cal and insurance and by doctors aging out and retiring. Lower reimbursements for government coverage is also having an effect. A possible answer, letting nurse practitioners see patients without a doctor's supervision. We'll debate it right after the news.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
That's why I love Southern California. What Hetty just said, chilly temperatures in the 50s, she's right for us. People, other parts of the country, be dancing in the streets for 50-degree temperatures in February. So good to have you with us on Air Talk today. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, as you just heard, State of the Union Address, 6 o'clock, our time right here on 89.3, followed by the Democratic response. President Trump may expand on his proposal that would require prescription drug rebates go directly to consumers, would bypass the discounts now going to health insurers and middlemen. Some patients would pay less for drugs, but others would likely see premiums go up. We'll look at the pros and cons later this hour. But first, another important health care matter, finding enough primary care doctors in California. It's a big problem, and for a number of issues. One, the fact that many more California residents are now covered by either private health insurance through the state insurance exchange or via Medi-Cal. And factor into that as well, lower reimbursements for the government health care, which has made some primary care physicians a little shy about seeing those patients. Also, just an aging medical core of doctors in the state as they're retiring. So the question is, what fills that gap? One of the proposals to come out of a task force study of this issue is allowing nurse practitioners in the state to operate independent of a physician's license. Joining us to talk about how that might work is president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, Joyce Nestrick. Joyce, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with how this would work. Currently, nurse practitioners see patients, but under at least the indirect supervision of a physician?
That's correct. So they have to have a link to a supervising physician in California. Now, that doesn't mean the physician is even in the same building with them, but that they are somehow linked, by their licensure to a supervising physician. So oftentimes that means they have to pay someone with a different medical license versus a nursing license to supervise their work.
And how is the training of nurse practitioners differentiated from other nurses? What is the extra expertise, training, or experience that nurse practitioners have?
So, you know, nurse practitioners are educated within the nursing model of education. And so we come from a holistic, we look at health disparities, look at health promotion. And then at the graduate level, nurse practitioners are educated either at the master's or the doctor of nursing practice level. So generally we have about, with our RN education at the baccalaureate level plus our graduate level, we're looking at about 6 years of education combined as a nursing professional. And then with that graduate education component being focused on diagnosing, treating, illnesses and caring for patients in that realm.
And what are some of the kinds of things that a patient would present to a nurse practitioner that the nurse wouldn't necessarily have the expertise to diagnose and handle that would need to be referred to a primary care MD? What are some examples of where a gap would exist?
Well, many nurse practitioners practice in the primary care arena. I myself practice in primary care. Generally, we see patients with chronic conditions, acute conditions, and we order tests, diagnose problems, treat patients, and we also make referrals to patients. Now, generally speaking, we're working one-on-one with a physician in any type of practice. We would obviously have collegial collaboration within that practice. But normally, myself, I practice without a physician in my practice, and so therefore I would generally refer out to a specialist if a patient is outside of my
It sounds like there's really no gap in your expertise versus a primary care physician. You're saying your referral would be to a specialist. It sounds like you don't refer to a primary care physician. Is that right?
No, I would not.
Okay, so it'd be you'd see it as an equivalent expertise to the primary care physician. Now, in the case where, like in your practice, where there's not an MD who's on site, what then is the MD providing? Does she or he at all check in on what's going on in your practice? Is it just that she or he are vouching for your expertise? What is that relationship like?
So I practice in a state that does not require a collaborative agreement, and I'm not supervised.
Okay.
So therefore, it would be in a state we call full practice authority. Now, I do have a medical director who at times has not been a physician, but now happens to be a physician, and everyone in the practice, including any physicians that would come through, would report, you know, to the medical director just as you would in any system. So, no, I don't have a collaborative agreement. And before, some years ago, when I did have a collaborative agreement, we very much worked in a collaborative spirit where I looked at some of his notes and gave him feedback. He looked at some of mine. And, you know, we did independent audits of each other. And that worked very well in a collaborative type of relationship.
So what's contemplated here in California sounds like very much like in your state where you're practicing, where nurse practitioners would be independent of a licensed physician.
Yes.
All right. We're talking with Joyce Nestrick, who's president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. Recommendation has come out of a state task force that California look at nurse practitioners as providers of primary care independent of an MD. Currently, California, one of the states that requires an MD to provide oversight for nurse practitioners. I'd like to hear your thoughts about this. If you're in the healthcare field, what do you think? We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722. Nurse practitioners, nurses, physicians, health administrators, I'd be very interested in hearing your thoughts about this. 866-893-5722. Also with us from the California Medical Association, which opposes having nurse practitioners working independently, Senior VP of Governmental Relations, Janice Norman. Janice, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So first of all, in what way do you think this would diminish care to have nurse practitioners providing full primary care services?
So first, let me back up and make sure that we level set about what we're actually contemplating. In your discussion with Ms. Nestrick, and I hope I'm not mispronouncing your name, apologize if I am, the discussion was really about someone who has been in practice for a long time. The way the law works is it's looking at someone coming fresh out of academic training and residency as a requirement. And so when you compare a physician's education and training, 4 years of medical school, and then the state now requires 3 years of a residency program, Now, that is an increase in its residency requirement that was just enacted. The purpose of a residency program, if I had to oversimplify it, is two things. One, to ensure that the supervised doctor, and I do want to make that point clear, that in California, we do not allow a physician to leave medical school and practice independently because they haven't proven competency, which is critically important. So we increased the requirement in California for a physician from 1 year of a residency program to 3 years of a residency program minimum to ensure competency. The second portion of it is to ensure that they've had a wide range of experience so they know diseases, common diseases with a common presentation, as well as common diseases with a unique presentation. In other words, to understand what they know, but more importantly, to understand what they don't know in order to refer.
So compare and contrast that with nurse practitioner training.
Nurse practitioner training is mostly on the academic side. And so it requires an RN, but then it requires graduate education. In California, there's no residency requirement, which equates to there's no requirement for competency no requirement for competency in order to prove that you are ready to independently practice. And that's dangerous when you talk about patient care, when you talk about primary care being those gatekeepers that send you out to specialists if you need it or provide the treatment themselves. And so in California, what's really important is at the end of the day, through that supervisorial relationship, a physician is overseeing the care of the patient.
All right. But let me ask you about the other states. What, there's 20-some states that allow nurse practitioners to treat independently. Are they seeing problems in the quality of care or competency for nurse practitioners to act as de facto primary care docs?
I represent California. Here's what I will tell you. When I go back to the meetings of the AMA, physicians are concerned about independent practice across the state. When I have conversations with clinical directors here in California that hire NPs straight out of their academic training, they have concerns about all of the time it takes to get the NP up to speed. It's almost as if they're doing on-the-job training to make sure that they are competent enough to expand their role within that care team. It's not a turnkey solution. And so I don't want your listeners to think that you're talking about an equivalency.
Let me take some listener calls here. That's Janice Norman, who's Senior VP Governmental Relations for the California Medical Association, which opposes this proposal on nurse practitioners. Joyce Nestrick is the president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. Let's talk with Omid in downtown Los Angeles. I understand you're in your resident training. Omid, your thoughts on nurse practitioners having this degree of authority?
Hey, Larry. Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely a role, primarily if primary care physicians are referring chronic stable patients to nurse practitioners. But I think if we see mid-level providers such as nurse practitioners taking all of primary care independently, that is going to disincentivize medical students to go into primary care.
All right. And you just think that because it's a less time-consuming process to become a nurse practitioner, my people who would go into getting their MD instead become a nurse practitioner, do you think?
I mean, there's definitely a that could be good for some people who want a shorter training period and if that fits their lifestyle better. But I think the compensation is, in general, lower for nurse practitioners. And if they become the primary caretakers for, you know, outpatient medicine for a lot of people, I don't see much incentive for a medical student with a few hundred thousand dollars of debt to go into that specialty.
All right. I appreciate it very much, Omid. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Bobby asked the question whether nurse practitioners are able to bill for the same rates with Medi-Cal, private insurance companies, Medicare. Joyce Nestrick, do nurse practitioners receive the same reimbursement rates?
So first I wanted to say that nurse practitioner care has over and over again been proven to be safe, quality, and cost-effective. And if you look at the American Enterprise Institute report and the recent Brookings Institute report, the public can be assured that nurse practitioners provide safe, high-quality, cost-effective care. And we don't call ourselves mid-level providers. We call ourselves nurse practitioners. Second of all, yes, we do receive billing, and we are able to bill under our own NPI number. At this point, we receive 85% under Medicare and 85% generally in Medicaid programs, and it really depends on the state. If you're in a federally qualified health center, you would receive 100% like the other providers.
Now, 85%...
under our own name, and we should be billing under our own name.
If it's an 85% reimbursement, given it's a private practice, the cost of rent, malpractice insurance, all that, is that doable to see government patients with that?
It makes up the difference in the practice by the quality of care that the nurse practitioner sees. And as a matter of fact, many nurse practitioners are still are open, and because we work in rural and underserved areas, are more likely to see patients who are on Medicare and Medicaid, Medi-Cal, I guess, in your case.
Okay, but my question was about it. I mean, there's enough money coming to the practice with that lower degree of reimbursement.
Oh, absolutely. We already have nurse practitioners who have independent practices in the state of California. In fact, there is one right now who will probably have to close her practice down, where she sees over 700 patients a month because she cannot find a supervisory physician in her area. And her practice is mostly made up of Medi-Cal patients who will not have access.
All right. Let me break. I'll continue our conversation with Joyce Nestrick, president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, Janice Norman of the California Medical Association, senior VP Governmental Relations. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Angriest in L.A. writes on the Air Talk page, I go to a doctor's office which uses nurse practitioners, and I love it. First time I get enough time with my medical professional to review all my issues in detail. If there are any questions, the NP then checks with the overseeing doctor. I get all the referrals I need to specialists. I never had this kind of attention when I was seeing a regular doctor. I finally had multiple ongoing issues for years dealt with and treated. It doesn't sound angry in L.A. That's angriest writing on the page. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Marcia in Los Angeles said, my mother was seeing a nurse practitioner for 2 years who failed to diagnose a brain tumor. Elderly patients can confuse doctors with nurse practitioners and confuse their expertise. That's Marcia in Los Angeles. Let's talk with Michael in Culver City. Michael, I understand you operate 3 medical clinics.
I have operated 3 medical clinics in my career over the past 20 years. Currently, I'm operating one as an administrator and a manager, yes.
What do you think of this proposal to allow nurse practitioners to operate independently?
I don't think it's a good idea. I know that nurse practitioners do provide a valuable service in primary care. However, they have been doing a good job, as your guest did mention on that study, because they are under a supervision of a physician most of the time. Now, the majority of the patients that would come in to see a nurse practitioner, we found out that the nurse practitioners were able to treat their issues, but I would say about 20 to 25% of the time, the nurse practitioner needed to consult with a physician, whether it be in person or over the phone. And that's why we provided good care, because the nurse practitioners would provide care for follow-up and for simple cases. However, if a case was complicated, the physician was consulted. So I do not think it would be a good idea or safe for patients if they were to see a nurse practitioner that is operating independent of a physician.
All right, I appreciate it. Michael, Joyce Nestrick, president of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners. Michael said 20 to 25% of the things presented to the nurse practitioner, there was the need for the nurse to consult with a physician. Your response to that?
Well, I've not seen that in my practice, and I've been practicing for 25 years independently as a nurse practitioner. You know, nurse practitioners see over a billion patients a year. We have, in the West Coast, most of the other states are full practice authority states. Your neighboring states of Oregon, for example, has and Washington have great successes. In fact, I'm kind of surprised that California is lagging behind when we normally look at it as being a state that is known for its innovation and access to care. So I would say if you really look at the studies that are out there, that would not prove true. I would wonder if we looked at the amount that other providers refer out, it may be in that same figure. So I don't see that in my practice.
Okay.
I certainly know, you know, what my limitations are as a primary care provider and when I need to call a specialist in to help with the patient. Because for nurse practitioners, the patients and access, you know, to high quality care is of utmost importance.
Let's talk with Donish in the Mid Wilshire District. You're on Air Talk.
Hi, my concern is that this plan legislation is going to only pass the buck. I work with a union that represents nurse practitioners in our prisons, and they provide a very valuable service. I mean, these prisons are in remote parts of the state. It's hard to get doctors, and the nurse practitioners come in and do a commendable job. But the problem is that the prisons can't recruit doctors into these places in the Imperial Valley up in Tulare County. And I think that if we just continue to delegate to nurse practitioners, we're not solving the problem, which is that doctors are not willing to work in these places. And as the resident said, you know, it's only incentivizing, you know, people who are going into medical school to continue going into specialty fields. And those specialty fields are going to be concentrated in Los Angeles and San Francisco, where they can practice at, you know, first tier medical facilities like UCSF, Cedars-Sinai, and UCLA. And so while nurse practitioners are important to, you know, providing care to people throughout the state, my concern is just that this is passing the buck and really not addressing the issue at the core of the problem.
Donish, I appreciate it very much. Thanks. Let's talk next with Grace in South Pasadena. Grace, you're a physician, I understand. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a huge difference between the knowledge of a nurse practitioner and a doctor, specifically because, number one, I'm just going to be very blunt. You have the brightest students graduating from undergraduate school going to medical school, whereas, you know, you're basically taking from a different pool going to nurse practitioner school. And I work a lot with nurse practitioners, and I think they're good as and very useful and efficient as a mid-level, but definitely not as the primary care provider.
So you're a doctor. You work with significant numbers of nurse practitioners. You feel as though that, I mean, there are two things. One is the educational level. The other, you're kind of getting to the aptitude of the provider. So you're saying essentially doctors are the best and the brightest. The nurse practitioners don't come from that pool?
That is, yes, that's one point because of how the system is set up. You get the brightest people going to medical school. And number two, the nurse practitioners may go to school for another, after they have their nursing degree, for another 2 or 3 years. Afterwards, the only education that they have is on the job, depending on which doctors they work with, that they can learn whatever skills that doctor might give them. So it's very limited. If you're lucky, you'll work with a very smart doctor that can, you know, help you with that field. But most of the time, who knows where you're getting your actual on the job, your residency training from.
All right.
You have no residency training. And it's a huge difference.
Grace, I appreciate your call. Joyce Nestrick, quick response to that.
Well, two things. One, we have education as an RN where we touch patients before we come in to medical school, clinical experiences. Second of all, our education is competency-based, and we teach competency throughout, and there's no studies that show that we're not qualified. And two, the call regarding the presidency should really look at the American Enterprise Institute report that shows exactly why physicians will not go into rural and underserved areas. And thirdly, I really take offense at the last caller's remarks. I had a degree in chemistry before I went into nursing, and so I think we are the best and the brightest people that come in to become nurse practitioners. So I personally...
I'm assuming that there are significant numbers of people who go into nurse practitioner because there are other barriers to going into training to be a physician. They might, like yourself, come from other academic backgrounds or other kinds of practices. So this nurse practitioner enables people to come from diverse academic backgrounds. Joyce Nestrick, thank you so much. President of the American Association of Nurse Practitioners, Janice Norman, California Medical Association. You can share your comments about whether nurse practitioners should be able to operate independent of oversight from MDs here in California. President Trump gives his State of the Union address this evening, 6 o'clock. You'll hear it live, NPR coverage right here on 89.3, followed by the Democratic response and analysis from NPR's experts. One of the things the president might well touch on is a prescription drug discount proposal that's being pushed by Alex Azar, the head of Health and Human Services. The idea is that the discounts, the rebates, now being offered to private insurance companies and to middlemen, that would go directly to the health consumer. Now, under that proposal, it could be big savings for those who pay the most for their prescription drugs, but it might mean higher costs in health insurance premiums for others. Joining us is Michelle Mello, Stanford University Professor of Law and Health Research. She's also a consultant to CVS Caremark, the pharmacy benefits manager. Professor Mello, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you see as the advantage of having these rebates, these discounts, go directly to the consumer?
Well, the system we have now is has some perversities in several respects. The main problem is that by operating on a series of rebates and discounts that go along the supply chain, it creates incentives for drug companies to set their sticker prices, their list prices, high, and then cut deals along the way that benefit middlemen. And we know very little about the extent to which these cost savings get passed along to patients, but the suspicion is that those in the middle of the supply chain may be taking quite a big cut. So by mandating that any discounts that are given go all the way to the patient, the prospect is that all of these savings get passed fully along, and there are certain classes of patients, as you intimate, that will benefit from that greatly. There are others who end up paying more in the form of higher premiums.
So as you look at that trade-off, you think on balance the benefit to those who pay the most for prescriptions, have the most expensive ones that they need, that is more of a benefit than the detriment of people who pretty much get no prescriptions or generics paying more for their insurance premiums.
You know, I think it just depends on what your values are in the system. But, you know, the function of insurance is supposed to be to create a big risk pool and to spread costs across a population. And the system we have right now for prescription drug coverage very much concentrates out-of-pocket costs in a small segment of the population that is very sick. So if you're a person who would like to see a better safety net for all, this proposal would appeal to you. If you're someone who wants to keep your premiums exactly where they are at the risk that you will someday become one of these people who's extremely needy on the prescription drug front, this is a proposal that might give you some pause.
And just real briefly before we break for news, is this a way that potentially you've got, for lack of a better term, the rack rate, the stated cost of a drug ends up being higher, even though the insurers don't pay based on that, but then the consumer ends up paying the copay based on an artificially inflated cost? Is that what happens?
So that's one of the problems that this proposal is targeting. And many people don't realize that. For people who are going into a pharmacy in January, as we all are, many of us now, paying towards our new deductible for the year, when we pay our 20%, it's not based on the cost that our health plan paid for the drug. It's based on the sticker price, even though nobody paid that price. And the same goes for cost sharing. So that's one of the problems that this seeks to
do. All right. We'll continue our conversation with Stanford University's Michelle Mello, professor of law and health research. We'll also hear from America's Health Insurance Plans. They're opposed to this. We'll talk with Kristen Groh from that organization and from USC's Schaefer Center for Health Policy, director of the center, Jeffrey Joyce. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about a Trump administration proposal that the rebates that now go from prescription drugs to insurance companies or to the middle level, the middlemen, so to speak, that discount go directly to the consumer who's paying the copay or the deductible on the big ticket prescription drug. That obviously has health insurance plans concerned. With us, Kristen Groh, Senior VP of Communications for AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans. Ms. Groh, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are your concerns about how this would affect not just your industry, but health consumers?
We're concerned that this is going to make premiums go up and taxpayer burden go up. I know that Big Pharma has been working very hard to position health insurance providers and pharmacy benefit managers as middlemen. The fact of the matter is we are the bargaining power of the consumer. We work with the pharmaceutical companies and drug makers to negotiate lower prices for them, and those savings are all returned to the consumers through lower premiums and lower out-of-pocket costs for the drugs and services that they get. The fact of the matter is we're projected to save consumers about $650 billion over the next 2 years, but rules like this one are going to take us backward because they take away a key piece of leverage that we have and don't replace it with anything that allows us to negotiate lower prices.
Well, what about the point, though, that what the consumer ends up paying, their portion is often based on what's really kind of a phony price for the drug that no one really pays. If insurers actually based the copay, the portion the consumer pays, on what the insurance company really pays overall, wouldn't that be a fairer way to do it, to provide that level of transparency?
I think you have to look at a couple of things. First of all, the number of drugs that are actually rebated is a comparatively small number. For example, generic drugs or drugs that are in a protected class or drugs that are brand name drugs but don't have any generic competitors, those do not receive rebates because there's no incentive for pharmaceutical companies to give them because those drugs need to be covered. So when you're talking about rebated drugs, they're a very small number for which a generic equivalent is usually available. So it's not everybody that sees a drug that's rebated. So what we're talking about is to see a small savings, at least for a first couple of months in a benefit year at the pharmacy counter, perhaps, what you'd be looking at is premiums going up 19% for everybody in the year 2020 and then 25% over the year 2020 to 2029. That's right. The other thing is I think you have to remember that when you're paying a copay at the pharmacy counter, it's for the entire year. So once you meet that deductible, your health plan is covering the rest of that drug cost throughout the year.
All right. Well, let me bring into the conversation from USC's Schaefer Center for Health Policy, the director, the center and chair of the Department of Pharmaceutical and Health Economics at the School of Pharmacy, Jeffrey Joyce. Thank you, sir, for being with us. I'd like to get your response, first of all, to what Kristen Groh just contended, a 19 to 25% hike in premiums on average for those covered by health plans to pay for the rebates going directly to the consumer. Your response to that?
I do think that's largely a scare tactic. I think most academic estimates are in the range of $4 to $5 premium increases. And if you look at Medicare Part D, so this is generally, the government has proposed doing this for Medicare and Medicaid. Only a small minority of beneficiaries will see these premium increases. So about half of beneficiaries get their drug coverage through these comprehensive sort of HMO Medicare Advantage plans. Some get them through their employer and it's subsidized by Medicare. And low-income seniors get their drug benefits subsidized by through Part D. So the fraction of beneficiaries who would face that premium increase would be modest, and the premium increase itself would be in the range of $4 to $5 per month, not 19 to 25%.
So you don't think that the increase in premiums would end up across the board to compensate for the loss of those rebates going to the insurers?
No. And as Michelle Mello, I think, articulated early on in your segment, the people who pay the most, who generate that rebates, are those are the high-cost users, and they're the ones bearing the price of these rebates. Those rebates are then, some fraction of them are then used to lower premiums. So I think premiums in Medicare Part D are artificially low at the backs of the sickest and highest users of prescription drugs.
Christine Groh's point, though, is that once the patients, these heavy users of services or prescription drugs, once they reach their deductible, then the financial burden really ends at that point. It's borne fully by the insurer.
No, I mean, Medicare Part D has a complicated benefit structure, there is a deductible, there's a catastrophic phase, there's also a coverage gap. There are plenty of people who pay a percentage of that list price. And if that list price, as you noted, is artificially inflated, consumers end up bearing a higher fraction of an artificial price.
Christine Groh, you want to respond to that?
Yes, I think I'm very glad that you actually brought up the piece about subsidies and other people paying costs, because further projections these projections are from CMS's Office of the Actuary, by the way, that federal spending, which is taxpayer spending, will increase $196 billion from 2020 to 2029 as a result of the rule. So it's not just increased premiums, it's increased taxpayer burden. We just think that that's certainly not necessary. If we want to bring down drug prices, let's bring down the prices rather than take away a negotiating tool that we have to make those prices lower. In this rule that tackles drug prices themselves.
Michelle Mello of Stanford University, are you concerned that if premiums rise, if this policy is enacted, that it could discourage further people from signing up for health care, or that in some way it could lead to an overall decline in people getting the drugs they need?
No, I think that's not a chief concern for me. What I would say is that a lot of the potential impacts on premiums are pretty speculative at this point. There were three analyses that the federal agency that issued this rule commissioned to try to understand the impacts. And with regard to the effect on both federal and state government spending, the estimates were very different, even in different directions. So that, Ms. Groh cited one estimate, there was another estimate in the opposite direction. And the reason there's so much uncertainty about that and about the downstream effects on consumers and their ability to buy health care is we don't know how manufacturers are going to respond to this. In the best case scenario, they move their sticker prices down to basically the average net price that they're actually selling the drugs at today under this system of discounts and rebates, and everybody wins. The discounts get passed along to consumers, and we all pay less. The worst case scenario, though, is that they don't move their sticker prices down much at all. They keep them close to where they are. They just don't give discounts. And they count on the fact that a lot of health plans are going to be under a tremendous amount of pressure to continue covering those drugs, are not going to be able to say no, and they're going to have to buy the drugs at a higher price. So until we figure out what kind of strategic behavior ensues on the part of manufacturers, it's hard to know what the bottom line effect is going to be. But one should be a little bit worried when the trade organizations for the two leading biopharmaceutical industries come out in favor of this proposal. This is something they like, which says to me they've got a strategy here for protecting their margins.
Michelle Mello, thank you for being with us. Stanford University Professor of Law and Health Research. Kristen Groh of AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and Jeffrey Joyce, USC's Schaefer Center for Health Policy, also chair of the Pharmaceutical and Health Economics Department at the SC School of Pharmacy, which is internationally renowned. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up, the Lakers proposing essentially to back up the moving van and to put just about all the young guys on the roster into the truck and take them off to New Orleans in exchange for one of the NBA's greatest stars. Would that be a good deal or not? And would the New Orleans Pelicans actually make such a move? We'll talk about that with A. Martinez and the Los Angeles Times LA Lakers beat writer. Back with more in a minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. No secret that the Lakers would love to acquire forward Anthony Davis from the New Orleans Pelicans, one of the very best players in the NBA, dominant power forward. And the trade deadline is approaching. It's at noon on Thursday. The Lakers reportedly dangling just about two-thirds of their roster. All these young guys who were top draft picks that the Lakers were building around. But, of course, with LeBron James on the Lakers roster, they're looking to potentially win now. Will New Orleans take what the Lakers are offering, or will they hold off till the offseason? Anthony Davis's agent has said that Davis wants to go elsewhere and will not re-sign with the Pelicans. With us to talk about this potential fork in the Lakers' road, A. Martinez, the host of Take Two. A, good to have you with us.
Hi, Larry.
And Tanya Ganguly, Lakers beat writer for the Los Angeles Times. Tanya, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So, Tanya, let's talk first. What from your reporting on this, are the Lakers offering New Orleans for Davis?
Well, they increased their offer. Their initial offer included five different possibilities. One of them involved four of their young players plus a first-round pick. Then yesterday, Magic Johnson and Dell Demson, the Pelicans' general manager, had a couple conversations. And after those conversations, Johnson offered a package that included two first-round picks. It included six players, including Lonzo Ball, Kyle Kuzma, Brandon Ingram, Rajon Rondo, Michael Beasley, and Lance Stephenson. And it also offered to take a contract from the Pelicans that was for $13 million, that is for a player who will be earning $13 million next year, which the Lakers plan to stretch and create a little more cap space for them. But it gives the Pelicans a little bit of salary cap relief. So that's what they're offering now in terms of where they are, what they could offer, what more they could offer. Player-wise, there's not a ton more.
It's about all of their players, aside from LeBron James, anyone would want. Tanya, what is Dell Demps, the general manager of New Orleans, probably thinking about weighing doing this deal with the Lakers now or waiting to when the Boston Celtics would be free at the end of this season to make their offer for Davis?
The things that the Pelicans have to be weighing are, do they want, it's the bird in the hand versus the bird in the bush. The Celtics are very insistent that they want to go for this. They're not deterred by the fact that Anthony Davis has not included them on his list of teams that he'd like to sign with long term. They're not deterred by his father coming out and saying he doesn't want to play there. There's all these different things that have been swirling around, but the Celtics are really still interested. And what they're promising is that they'll make a very competitive offer in the summer. They can't do it right now because of an obscure rule that won't allow them to have traded for Kyrie Irving and also Anthony Davis. What the Pelicans can get now, though, is a sure thing. So they know what the Lakers can give them. They aren't making any assumptions. And there are people that are insisting that the Lakers offer won't be as good in the summer.
All right. We're talking with Tanya Ganguly, Lakers beat writer for the LA Times. So, this is a fundamental shift for the Lakers. They've been building around young talent they've drafted, the guys Tanya just mentioned, and then they get LeBron James coming into this season. If they dump all these guys, switch direction to get Davis, what do you think? Does that make sense?
Well, they were building that young team before they got LeBron James. Once they got LeBron James, that changed the dynamic completely because LeBron James is not 24 years old. He's 34 years old. And you don't know how long that window will be open for him to continue to be one of the greatest players in the NBA. Arguably, he's number one on a lot of people's lists. So that means that that long-term plan that they had all of a sudden became a very short-term plan with a very small opening in that window. So that's why they probably want to take advantage of this. And here's the thing. With young players, Eric Karros, Dodgers first baseman, when I was doing my Dodger talk days a million years ago, he would always say this about young players with potential. They're magic beans. Sure, they look great and they offer all kinds of abilities to grow into a beanstalk someday, but you still never know. So if the Lakers, and with Magic Johnson in charge, are really trying to take advantage of LeBron James' final years of his prime, then yeah, it makes sense to make that move.
Well, and with Lonzo Ball, I raised this issue with Rob Pelinka going into last season. As you know, he is injured throughout his college career. He's now been injured time after time as a professional. I question his durability as an NBA, as gifted as he is as a player. So Lonzo, you know, if he goes, that's kind of a risk even for the Pelicans. And Brandon Ingram shows flashes of greatness, but is not consistent night in, night out. Still very, very young. And Kyle Kuzma, to me, is the most dynamic of that trio. I'd really hate to see him go, but Davis plays the same position.
Yeah, with Lonzo Ball, he was playing really well before he sprained his ankle against the Houston Rockets.
He's
I was
so
watching
talented.
That game. Yeah, but here's the thing, though. Another young player way back that was having sprained ankle issues all the time, and people were saying, well, this guy, talented, but you never know if he's going to be on the court, was Steph Curry. Steph Curry sprained his ankle almost like
but
clockwork.
But that's not the only injuries that he had. Tanya, I'm curious your thoughts on this, because, I mean, it seems like from his wrist, it's been one thing after another with Lonzo.
Well, his rookie year, he for sure had a lot of different injury issues, and that was a thing that the Lakers addressed with him when he came into when he finished his season, and they had their exit meeting with him. They said, "We want you to play. We want you to get in the weight room and be more durable." And he said he wanted to play all 82 games. Then he had that freak injury. It's a torn, a completely torn ligament in his left ankle. And it was really disappointing for him and for the Lakers because, like you said, he was playing really well up until that point and he had sort of figured something out. So I don't know if you can call this injury as part of a pattern. I will say he had another injury earlier in the year that he came back from pretty quickly during the preseason. But he came back from really quickly, and that showed some growth for him in terms of what he's able to work with and how he's able to think about his body.
It's hard as a fan. I get so excited when I see Lonzo out there doing what he can do, and then he's on the shelf. Rob, Air Talk listener, asks on the page, well, how do you win a championship with no supporting cast? Because they're talking about so many players potentially in this deal, let alone the draft picks that Tanya was mentioning in the latest offer. Who then would play alongside James and Davis?
Well, that's who you would address in the offseason. I think they might be able to still have room for one more max player. And Tanya, you could correct me if I'm wrong on this one. So where they wouldn't be completely bare heading into next season, but you still need to get that other superstar. Right now, you only have one. L.A. is a big town that loves its superstars. You kind of need more than one or two to sell that.
Well, and do you want to write off this season? I mean, Tanya, the Lakers thing, if they get Davis, they can compete this year for a title.
If the Lakers get Anthony Davis, to address the salary cap question first, they would not have the deal that they're talking about right now. They would be close to another max guy in the summer, but they wouldn't be quite there. They'd have to have somebody would have to take a discount. So that's where that stands. But without Anthony Davis, yes, they do have the room for another max guy. And you know, the thing about teams like this is if Anthony Davis and LeBron James are playing on the same team, there will be plenty of players that will want to come, that will be willing to take one-year deals and will want to fill out the roster. So I think what you mentioned earlier, that their window, they have a small window right now because LeBron is not in his 20s.
Yeah.
He's not going to, you know, he wants to play for, I think, 4 or 5 more years, and I'm sure he can. But they have to think in terms of they don't want to waste.
No, that's so true. Tanya, I'm sorry I got a break in there, but we're out of time. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Tanya Ganguly, LA Times, Laker beat writer, A. Martinez of Take Two.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by February 18th to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
When an earthquake hits, you need to drop, cover, and hold on.
Definitely there will be the perception that the ground is literally waving in front of you.
But what do you do after the shaking stops? When the power is out, the roads are blocked. I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. I've got plenty of answers for you. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up a little bit later, the ongoing debate about whether eating breakfast helps someone control weight or lose weight. We'll hear the pros and cons of that a little bit, but I just got some disturbing information about one of our employees, Matt D'Angelo-Antonio, talking with one of our guests from Massachusetts who's coming on. And Mr. Patriots fan himself asked her if she could see the victory parade. Matt, I think it's time you train your successor. Patriots fan, oh well, no, you deserve it. As the Patriots are enjoying their victory parade, beating the Rams in the Super Bowl on Sunday. So good to have you with us. Also coming up a little bit later this hour, we're going to talk about wearable technology from shoes. Nike has these self-tying shoes that can monitor all kinds of things. How far would you go with the clothes you wear, your footwear, hats, measuring what you do throughout the course of the day? At what point does that become intrusive? But first, we turn our attention to a proposed bill in Sacramento that would ban California doctors from treating children or performing surgery on children with genitals that don't fit a single gender or are otherwise atypical. That applies to about 1 in 2,000 births in California. So this is not a super rare issue. The question is, should minors have control, be able to make the final call as to whether such surgery is performed? What about if it's deemed a medical necessity? What would that process look like? Joining us is Executive Director of Interact, a nonprofit advocating for intersex youth, Kimberly Zieselman, who is in Massachusetts, where Patriots fans are celebrating. Kimberly, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
I appreciate it. So I understand that you underwent surgery when you were a teenager. Is that right?
I did. I had a surgery that I was unaware of the truth of that surgery and didn't consent to when I was a child. And that is what got me interested in advocating for these issues on behalf of all children born with intersex traits. As you may or may not know, intersex is an umbrella term that applies to a wide variety of conditions that result in an intersex birth. And in my case, I had XY chromosomes, which are thought of as typically male chromosomes, and internal testes. I was born with the androgen insensitivity syndrome, and as a result, had surgeries to remove my otherwise healthy testes and attempt to create a vagina on me. And this was something that I didn't need, nor did I want. I was a healthy child. This was, of course, I'm a bit older, and this, of course, was a few years ago. But the sad news is that these surgeries are still happening to intersex people without their consent.
At what age do you, and I don't know if you feel like you have an age where you would have been able to make an informed decision. Generally, do you think there is an age where someone can determine if she or he wants to have this surgery?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think it varies depending on each person and the circumstances and the environment. There's so many factors that go into that. So I'm hesitant to state a specific age that I think is necessary. I think in my case, personally, probably in my late teens, I would have been ready had I been given, and this is really important, all the appropriate information so that I can make a fully informed decision on my own. In my case, and sadly in cases still today, parents are put into the position of having to make a difficult decision and more often than not are not given all the information that they need to make this difficult decision. And they're trying to make the best decision on behalf of their child. What we advocate for in cases where there's no medical necessity, just to be clear, that children who are born with intersex traits should have a say in their own bodies and what is done to their own bodies, whether or not it reflects their gender identity or not. Of course, in those cases, it's very important that children make a decision. But even in cases where gender is not at issue, which frankly is the vast majority of cases where intersex kids, people are born with intersex traits, have a variety of different differences that are fixed or attempted to be fixed by the medical community to fit us into binary boxes of male or female, instead of letting healthy intersex people just be, essentially.
As born.
Or race.
Kimberly, I wanted to ask you a personal question. Please feel free if you'd rather not discuss it, because you're on to talk as an advocate for the band. But just to sort of make this more holistic for listeners who aren't familiar with people that at least they know are intersex, you mentioned that this is a difficult decision for parents. And I wonder, is this something, if you're comfortable talking about it, that you've revisited with your parents talking about their decision in your case or not?
Sure, I have. I've spoken to both my parents about this. And in my case, they did not have the full information. They, in fact, didn't know that I had XY chromosomes, for example, when they consented to surgery. They didn't know that they were testes that were being removed. They were told that it was underdeveloped female reproductive organs that needed to be removed, or they would potentially develop into cancer. And so, of course, they hear a doctor talking about cancer and, like many parents, consented to have surgery. What we now know is they were actually healthy testes that were producing hormones that my body needed. But this is a very, very common story. What has changed in the last 30 years is we have something called the internet now, right? So it's very hard for doctors to not tell parents that their children have intersex traits. But what they don't tell parents still is that they have the option to delay medical intervention.
All right.
And include their child in the decision-making process in the vast majority of cases.
Hold that thought. We're speaking with Kimberly Zieselman, Executive Director of Interact, a nonprofit advocating for intersex youth, the organization co-sponsor of the bill that's in the California State Senate, which, unless it's deemed medically necessary or the child consents that there would be no performing of surgery on children born with genitals that are considered atypical or that don't fit a single gender. Also with us is Dr. Peter Breton, practicing urologist in Santa Cruz. He's the president of the California Urological Association and the president-elect of the California Medical Association. Dr. Breton, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are your concerns about this legislation?
Well, the main concern is that we are probably throwing the baby out with the bathwater. The vast majority of patients with intersex are not in Kimberly's category. They are in a different category, which is pretty straightforward. And those patients, as well as their parents, benefit from this operation. Their psychological well-being, we have studies that show that. The problem that I'm alluding to is called congenital adrenal hyperplasia, And Kimberly's right in everything that she has said, and my heart goes out with her, because I think if you can delay surgery up to adolescence, then you could delay it after 18 and they can make their own decision. However, the vast majority of these patients with congenital adrenal hyperplasia present itself at birth, and these patients are usually genetic females. They have identified themselves, and we know this from studies, that they identify themselves as females. And what they have is an overactive, they lack an enzyme, so they make too much. They make too much of the male hormone, which is not supposed to be there, obviously, in females. And it hypertrophies or it enlarges the clitoris to the point that it pretty much looks like a penis. And obviously, if you are the family member of a genetic female and you have this disorder, and by the way, this disorder, they have to take prednisone the rest of their life or else they won't survive. So these decisions are made with a multidisciplinary team, pediatric endocrinologists, pediatric urologists, neonatologists, as well as pediatricians, and we have multiple studies. And I hate for this group, I have my own patients that have testified for this, and they have the patients have grown older, have applauded the surgery, and they're quite satisfied with it. But more importantly is that the perception of the family taking care of this patient from the get-go, early childhood, they know, you know, you're changing the diapers of these patients. They know that they are dealing, after corrective surgery, with a genetic female as well as a phenotypic or a female completely with a removal of the hypertrophy clitoris. And this is not ambiguous. This is defined. Now, in Kimberly's place, I agree 100%, but the bill that we are dealing with throws out all surgery, including the majority of patients who suffer from congenital adrenal hyperplasia.
If congenital adrenal hyperplasia was carved out of this, would you be comfortable then with this law being applied to other children?
That would solve a major portion of this problem, getting rid of any discussion. But you know what we have is, this is not a discussion with urologists. I've never seen this decision in family. It's a multidisciplinary team. Now, if surgery has been delayed, as in Kimberly's her own example, I think that could wait. I mean, if you have already become a teenager and you delayed it that long, then you could delay it all the way to the adulthood, and you should make the decision yourself. But what I'm discussing is exactly what you're questioning here. I would like to preserve that for congenital adrenal hyperplasia. We have data, strong data, to support that.
Okay. Let me go back to Kimberly Zieselman. Your response, first of all, to what Dr. Breton is describing, that in these cases of congenital adrenal hypoplasia, it's very clear the psychological benefits are quantifiable from studies, and that this should be done early on.
Well, I have to disagree with that. Unfortunately, the studies are not that clear. And in fact, you know, at least 1 in 8 children born with congenital adrenal hyperplasia do not identify as female. So talk about throwing out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, are we going to just sacrifice that 1 child in 8 and call them a genetic female and reduce the size of their phallus so that it is more appropriate in, you know, the doctors and their parents' eyes for a quote-unquote genetic female, which I also take issue with. We can't really talk about genetic males or genetic females. My body is a case in point, right? So I also think that we are not talking enough about the harms that are associated with these medical interventions on all children, including children with congenital adrenal hyperplasia.
What is the harm you see for those kids?
Well, I mean, just at a very basic level, there are always risks associated with surgery, of course. Recently the FDA issued a warning that anesthesia, for example, could cause serious damage to the developing brain in children who are under anesthesia under the age of three. I mean, quite a convincing study out of Australia about literacy rates and learning disabilities as a result. You know, that applies, of course, to all medical intervention on babies, but that's just one example. I can tell you that the psychological and emotional harms are pervasive, and they're not talked about enough. And I honestly don't think the doctors are taking these very seriously. It's not just patients like myself who were treated in the past. It is patients as young as, 10 years old, 13 years old, 19 years old, people, intersex youth that we work with in our organization who have had medical intervention and talk about their experiences in a way that is very similar to what a sexual abuse victim would talk about.
Let's talk specific. If this is a physical condition caused by a lack of enzymes, as we were hearing from the doctors, so you have this atypical development in the case of congenital adrenal hypoplasia.
Right.
Why would that cause a psychological harm to quote unquote fix something that's caused as a result of a lack of an enzyme that's typically there in female development?
Well, there is in congenital adrenal hyperplasia is a more complicated and as the doctor said, a very common intersex trait and perhaps one of the most, if not the most common intersex conditions. So there are a number of patients that we're talking about here, and a good number of them, and the doctor could tell more specifically, have true medical issues, and there's medical urgency around treating their condition. But that doesn't include surgery. That doesn't include surgery, certainly in reducing the size of their clitoris. So for medically necessary interventions, of course, I'm a parent as well. I have two adopted children. I would never want to prevent that from happening on my child. But when it's done for cosmetic reasons, sometimes, under the guise of arguably preventing urinary tract infections or some other nonsense that has no good studies behind it, that's where we draw the line.
Okay.
Congenital adrenal hyperplasia patients, young children need to be protected from the rest of us.
Let me bring a listener call in. Lori in Santa Monica, I understand you're an intersex person. What are your thoughts about this bill? Would you support it?
I would support it, and I want to reiterate that these are the only socially prescribed, medically unnecessary surgeries that are done to infants and children who have no say. And I would also like to say that whatever psychological issues there are, it is really the family that needs to start at an early age, not shaming the kids. By even doing things like surgeries and saying there's something wrong with you. Love the child as they are. Nature is beautiful in all of its forms and diversity.
Where, did you have surgery performed on you when you were a child?
Yes, but not the type of surgery that is really in discussion here.
All right. Lori, I appreciate your call. Let me go back to urologist Dr. Peter Breton, who's the president of the California Urological Association. Your response to the points of both Kimberly Zieselman and our caller, Lori.
Well, I could understand, again, their points, and my heart goes out to them. The issue, and Kimberly even pointed that, it's 1 out of 8, the best case scenario. I don't agree with that. If you agree, even when you agree with her, that means 87% of the people with congenital adrenal hyperplasia are going to benefit from that. It's much higher than that. The other part that she pointed out, and this is just untrue, that anesthesia causes developmental problems with brain development is just not true. If you'll have to show me that data, that's one data we have very safe anesthesia if necessary. That just does not exist. So we have safe anesthesia. We have multidisciplinary teams. We take this serious. There's far more psychological impairment if you don't let genetic females be raised to their fullest potential and be identified as they identify themselves as females. Now, I get the other part, but that's a small portion, and if we identify, just like the second caller or the first caller, that she did not even require any major surgeries, yes, I agree with psychological issues in this group of patients, and we don't operate currently on those patients.
I want to thank you, Dr. Breton, for being with us. He's president-elect, California Medical Association, currently presides over the California Urological Association and practices in Santa Cruz. You're listening to Wear Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, wearable technology. Nike, with its recent big announcement about its shoes that can do all kinds of things. Puma's followed. But beyond shoes, what are some of the other tech that you might find in your clothes? What can it monitor? And how do you feel about your clothes watching you? We'll be back in 1 minute. Well, you've heard of smartwatches, Google Glass. How about shoes that are the latest wearable technology? At the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas recently, Nike unveiled shoes that will lace themselves, but they have all sorts of additional technology. Puma also has its first pair of smart shoes. They're very expensive. You're talking about a few hundred bucks here. But like everything else, won't the prices come down? And when you go to buy some athletic footwear, even dresswear, you might find that it has technology embedded in it. What about other articles of clothing? Caps, shirts, pants. What do you think? What would you like to see or not? With us is Wired creative and senior editor of the publication, Peter Rubin, who's written about Nike smart shoe technology. Peter, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So what'll the Nikes do?
So the Nikes, and this is a very specific model, it's called the AdaptFit BB, and it kind of delivers on a promise that Nike has been working on for a long time. They put out a shoe about a year and a half ago that could lace automatically when you put your foot in, but what they've done is they've taken that, they've made it lighter, and they've made it connected. So there is not just this motor that will lace up the shoes around you, but there are a number of sensors embedded in the shoe, from a Bluetooth sensor that will pair with your phone, so you can tighten the shoe via an app to whatever you want them to be. You can tighten the left and the right independently. You can tighten them to presets that you set yourself. You can change the color in the shoe. But also in the shoe are an accelerometer and a gyroscope, not unlike the kind of motion sensors that you find in your phone. So what that means is that the shoe is able to know how it's oriented in space. And that doesn't matter yet. That isn't anything that the shoe is leveraging when it's first being released, which is this month. But in the future, that technology is going to allow it all sorts of new applications that we're just not used to having in our footwear.
Well, I would think, for example, you know, maybe starting with professional athletes, you could have a technology where the shoe senses an ankle twisting, for example, and somehow, you know, braces one side to help protect against an ankle roll, something like that. Is that what these athletic shoe manufacturers are considering?
That's a big part of it. Now, there's a little bit of a distinction in that kind of real-time reaction, I think, is certainly something that we are going to see. But for the time being, it's really meant for professional athletes to get a better fit that they can then relax. One of the things about NBA and WNBA players and their shoes is they're tied in a stranglehold, and their poor feet and ankles are dealing with that kind of unrelenting pressure in practices and in games. Now they can sit down on the bench and they can loosen it. And when it's time to go back on the court, they can tighten it exactly to the tightness that they had. And that tightness is a very specific kind of tightness in that it locks the foot into position and it doesn't allow it to slip, but it also isn't an undue amount of torque on the ankle or on the forefoot. So in the long run, Nike is hoping it's going to mitigate some of the long-term kind of deleterious effects that footwear can have on a professional athlete.
And would it allow you to have variable lacing? So for example, tighter further down the foot that's, say, looser at the top or vice versa. Is it that sophisticated in where it can apply pressure?
It is a two-zone lacing system, but it only translates to a kind of a single kind of tightness. So while you can adjust the left and the right one, in the time being for this particular shoe, you're only allowed to kind of tighten it overall. However, technology being what it is, this is going to trickle down. This is going to be cheaper and easier to get and in more kinds of shoes. It started with a sports-specific one at a very high level. This is a $350 shoe. It is not meant for, you know, the casual half-court player or whoever plays in the rec league at the YMCA or what have you. This is meant for high-level NBA, WNBA, possibly NCAA elite players.
Unless it's the Beverly Hills Y. Are they really planning to sell many of these, or is this more a display item to show where the technology is going?
I think they are meaning to sell it, and that's the difference between this and its predecessor, which was called the HyperAdapt 1.0. That necessitated a really kind of complex manufacturing process that Nike, frankly, wasn't used to. They had to kind of institute a lot of clutches. It was people at an electronics factory that would end up assembling a shoe. Now what they've done is they've recalibrated the technology that goes into the shoe so it can be done as part of a conventional manufacturing process at a footwear factory. And what that means is it's a wide-scale release. Of course, that means that it's probably going to be reserved right now, like I said, for high-level athletes and sneakerheads who don't mind spending $350 on what is right now a collector's item. But as time goes by, and almost certainly this year, you're going to see that become a less and less expensive way to get that sort of connectivity.
Peter Rubin of Wired with us talking about Nike's new generation smart shoe. Also with us from the USC Institute for Creative Technologies, researcher and computer scientist David Crum. David, thank you for being with us.
It's great to be here.
Where do you see this potentially going, looking, you know, down the road here, maybe 5-10 years?
Yeah, you know, I think this is part of a you know, of course, a larger trend. We all have smartphones and smartwatches, but, you know, the foot is a really interesting place to collect data. There's issues of gait and balance and movement, and it's possible that we could see this as a source of data to look at long-term health. And we could see spot problems that are small before they grow larger.
I'm wondering, even with physical therapy, for example, people who've suffered injuries and go through various exercises, is there a way that perhaps footwear, other clothing items could be used to help people make sure they're doing exercises correctly, for example? You know, are there training possibilities with connected clothing like this?
Yeah, definitely. When you do physical therapy or occupational therapy, you're only with the therapist for a small amount of time, you know, maybe each week or maybe each day if you're lucky. But if this is a system that can monitor you over time, you know, and all those off hours, it can really, you know, monitor, you know, are you using your legs properly or using your arms properly? And, you know, and potentially if there are some specific exercises, it could gamify those, so it could be more fun to do those exercises.
How much money are apparel manufacturers and designers putting into this? Do you have a sense, David Crum?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's always useful to, you know, invest some effort and bring some innovative technologies into a flagship product, which really helps, you know, push your brand out there. But, yeah, I'm not sure what the investment would be, you know, in terms of dollars.
All right. And, I mean, do you anticipate down the road that more of us than not are going to be wearing clothing that's smart connected, that we can learn about our physiology or workout or whatever via perhaps an app connected to what we wear?
Yeah, I think so. You know, the smartphone has really been a really good hub for pulling all these technologies together. But, you know, one thing to note is, you know, smart shoes, in fact, have been around for a long time, or they've been introduced over time. You know, this Puma shoe is not the first smart shoe that Puma released. There was one released in 1986.
1986.
Yeah, you could connect it to your Commodore 64.
That's pretty funny. Hey, David Crum, thank you so much. Peter Rubin of Wired, we appreciate it. David Crum is at the USC Institute for Creative Technologies. Coming up on Air Talk, breakfast. Eating breakfast has been touted as an important part of a balanced diet and also essential for maintaining or losing weight. But a new study on it calls that theory into question. We'll talk about the long history, contentious history of breakfast and what experts have thought of that first meal of the day. We'll be back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today in Fresh Air with Terry Gross is coming right up. Random House copy chief Benjamin Dreyer has his new book, Dreyer's English. He started writing about language advice on Twitter, of all places, and that's where he really developed a following for his advice on grammar and usage. Very unstuffy way to do it. He'll be with Terry Gross. Benjamin Dreyer, Random House copy chief, with Terry on Fresh Air, top of the hour, right here on 89.3 KPCC. Well, the debate continues over breakfast. Is it really the most important meal of the day? Is eating breakfast really essential for maintaining one's weight or losing weight? Or is it more complicated than that? A new study out of the University of Monash in Melbourne, Australia, looked at 13 randomized controlled trials on the effects of skipping breakfast on weight loss. That meta study found no evidence that omitting breakfast makes a person add pounds. Joining us to talk about the study is Professor of Clinical Epidemiology at the University of Monash in Melbourne, Flavia Secutini. Thank you very much, Professor, for joining us.
My pleasure. Hello.
Share with us how you did this meta study looking at these other studies on breakfast, because it seems like for many of us, we've been kind of confused on this issue.
Well, I think that's right. I think we all have. I see patients with joint pains and who need to lose weight, and I've been struck over the years that they invariably come back with, you know, being told they need to eat breakfast, with many of them almost force-feeding themselves breakfast. So we decided to look at the evidence, and so looked at all the randomized controlled trials that had been done, looking at people that skipped breakfast and those that didn't. And what we found was that, in fact, that people that had breakfast tended to be ingesting more calories, so about 260 calories a day more, and that they had a weight gain of about a pound. And so that seems to fit with people's individual experience, where there are some people that, you know, wake up in the morning and just seem to really need breakfast and find it hard to start the day without, but others that just don't feel hungry in the morning. And so really the message from our study is that certainly from the point of view of losing weight, that we certainly shouldn't be telling people they must eat breakfast.
Do you have a sense why there's that difference? Because what you described applies to so many people. I know people I know that if they didn't have breakfast soon after waking up, they'd be a mess. And then other people, there's just no hunger at all in the morning, and it takes them even a few hours for their appetite to activate. Why is that?
I can't answer that because that's beyond my expertise. But I do think that we tend to, in a lot of areas of advice, whether it be prevention or even treatment of conditions, use a one-size-fits-all. So we we make a decision, and then that's applied to everybody. Now, in the general principles are often a good idea, but I think that, you know, clearly people are made differently, and, you know, we need to take that into account, and I think this is just one example of that.
Joining us is Flavia Sicutini, who is Professor of Clinical Epidemiology, University of Monash in Melbourne. Also with us, Dr. David Katz, Founding Director of the Yale University Prevention Research Center, author of The Truth About Food, Why Pandas Eat Bamboo, and People Get Bamboozled. Dr. Katz, good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you, Larry. Thank you.
First of all, you have a thought about why we have such big differences between those who really need to eat breakfast first thing and those who just don't have an appetite till later?
Some insights. You know, I think Flavia was right to be humble about it. There's a lot in this space that we don't know. But we do know, for example, that people have very different rates of resting energy expenditure. That's, you know, the sort of the burn rate of calories when we're doing nothing. And because that differs significantly, someone with a high resting burn rate will wake up hungry. They will have depleted their energy reserve overnight. They're going to need to refuel first thing in the morning. People who are very prone to hypoglycemia, these dips in blood sugar, they tend to feel wiped out and they need to fill the tank routinely. Other people who have a slow burn rate, they're very fuel efficient. And you know, it is a nice analogy. Think of the difference between a highly fuel efficient car and a gas guzzler. People are put together that way too. So someone who's very fuel efficient, I'm in that camp. I'm not hungry in the morning. I can go for hours, and sometimes I have to remind myself, oh gee, I haven't had anything to eat yet today, and I don't feel it. So these days, almost everything we can attribute to variations in the microbiome, right? So when in doubt, guess the microbiome, and there's a good chance you'll be right. So it's genes, it's the microbiome, it's other things. But we don't have a complete answer, but there are some clues.
Then if someone has a default one way or the other around breakfast, would it make sense to honor that difference as a part of overall healthy eating, or could that be deceptive?
No, I think that's a really good insight, Larry. And I think I was brought in to be on the other side of a debate with Flavia, but I thought everything she said was entirely reasonable. And I think we would both agree that the one thing that needs to be off the menu is dogma. And, you know, the fundamentals of healthy eating and overall healthy dietary pattern, those really aren't negotiable. We are all members of the same species. There are common elements. But then we are put together differently, as Flavia says, and there is customization and personalization. And yes, if you wake up hungry and you don't eat breakfast, then you'll probably be ravenous or not feel well, and you'll overcompensate later in the day. If you wake up not hungry and are forced to eat breakfast, you'll wind up eating more calories than if you were just left to your own devices and said, hey, I'm hungry now and it's noon, so I guess this is lunch, not breakfast, but it's when I feel like eating. So yes, I think what we ought to do is build in that allowance for people to do it their way. And by the way, one thing that hasn't been part of the conversation and must be is what are people eating? You know, whether you eat at 7 a.m. or 9 a.m. or 11 a.m. or noon, call it breakfast, call it lunch, call it brunch, but whenever you eat, the quality of the food is going to matter, and that's true for everybody.
And I understand the general point on quality, but again, getting to individual differences, what that ideal food should be, even that is going to be different person to person, right?
To some extent. And you mentioned the book, Why Pandas Eat Bamboo and People Get Bamboozled, is my subtitle, and that's on purpose. You know, when we think about every species other than our own, we tend to start with the commonalities. So there are genetic variations among all the world's horses, but when it's time to feed them, we think oats and grass and hay because first and foremost, they're horses. And pandas do eat bamboo and koalas eat eucalyptus leaves and lions eat wildebeest. We are a species, we're more alike than different. And the fundamental components of a healthy diet for all Homo sapiens are minimally processed vegetables, fruits, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, whole grains for most people, plain water when thirsty, and dietary patterns can be built out from there. You're absolutely right. Some people are going to prefer a bit more protein. Some will prefer less. Some will do better on high fiber. Some will prefer a bit less. So, you know, I would say there's an overlay of personalization. Whether you have eggs for breakfast or steel-cut oats, may have something to do with your preferences and your metabolism. But on the other hand, really nobody should be having multicolored marshmallows, which are a mainstay in kids' cereals. And, you know, that's a huge problem.
You mean there's no one whose physiology would benefit from donuts every morning? That doesn't work, say it ain't so. We're going to take a break.
Maybe you.
All right. Yeah, I wish. All right. We're going to continue with Dr. David Katz, Yale University Prevention Research Center. He's founding director, author of The Truth About Food. We're also talking with professor of clinical epidemiology, Flavia Cicuccini of University of Monash in Melbourne, a lead author of this recent study, a meta study looking at randomized controlled trials on the effects of breakfast and skipping breakfast on weight loss. We'll continue and we take your calls, your questions for our experts at 866-893-KPECC. Back in 1 minute. I hope you'll be in the audience for our next Film Week Academy Awards preview, 17th annual program. Can't believe we've been doing it this long. And it's going to be again at the beautiful Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. Gorgeous historic venue. It began life as the United Artists flagship theater. First night, Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin on stage. That same stage where we'll be with our Film Week Academy Awards preview Sunday afternoon, February 17th, 1 o'clock. Tickets available, kpecc.org/in-person. Last year, we sold out our 1,600 tickets. We hope that you'll be there with us Sunday afternoon, February 17th, our Film Week critics on stage. I'll be taking them through the major categories. We'll see the clips from the top nominees on the huge screen there at the Theater at Ace Hotel. Sure hope to see you there. Right now, our focus is on breakfast and whether eating or skipping breakfast has an effect on maintaining or losing weight. If you have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Jay in Santa Ana said for diabetics, it's important to take morning medication with food and important not to skip a meal there. Dr. David Katz, Yale University Prevention Research Center, how might medication factor into the timing of when people eat?
Jay makes a crucial point. If you're taking insulin, one of the mainstays in dosing insulin is being able to predict when you're going to be introducing glucose into the bloodstream, having a predictable dietary pattern. So if you're on medication that can affect blood sugar or can affect metabolic rate, it may be really important to establish a stable pattern of dietary intake, and it may be important to distribute meals throughout the day. So, you know, this general study of effects of breakfast on weight, both the big randomized trials and the meta-analysis that Flavia and her colleagues conducted, is basically in healthy, overweight people. And so medications that will affect blood sugar levels, for example, are really not in the mix here. And Jay makes a very important point.
We have Michael in Alhambra said, I've been doing intermittent fasting for 7 months, so I haven't been eating breakfast. I lost 20 pounds in the first 2 months when I ate breakfast every day, even working out 5 days a week. It would take me 6 months to lose that. This works. Intermittent fasting, I know, is something that people try. Dr. Katz, any thoughts about, are there studies that show the efficacy or not of doing intermittent fasting? It's hard, I know, because all the variables.
Yeah, so there are. So just first, a little bit of a backstory here. When we talk about breakfast, Larry, we've made it a very simple variable, yes or no. But the reality is these studies define eating breakfast as anything before 10 a.m. and skipping breakfast anything after 11 a.m. for the most part. So it's just a 1 hour difference. So if you have your breakfast at 11:01 a.m., you're a breakfast skipper. The reality is if you eat later in the morning because that's when you're hungry, it's really lunch you may wind up. So you actually have breakfast, but you have it late. You skip lunch, you have only two meals instead of three, and that tends to work for restricting calories. The issue...
Do you need to get that call?
Sorry about that. No,
right,
I do
that's
not.
That's right. Oh, please, not
the issue the issue with intermittent fasting is exactly the same. So it's a tactic that can be used to limit the number of calories that you take in over the course of an average week. You can do that by being careful to the number of calories you eat every day. But you can also say, okay, 2 days out of seven, I just won't eat at all. And it's really hard for most people to make up the deficit of 2 whole days of not eating. So, yes, there are studies that show that strategy can work. And then it's a matter of, again, no dogma. What works for you? Would you rather focus on wholesome foods every day and portion control? Or would you rather say it's easier for me to limit my total calorie intake over a week if I just punch 2 holes in that week and skip 2 days? Some people don't like fasting. They don't feel well. They get a headache. They're sluggish. They can't be productive. Other people do very well. So this is another one of those opportunities to customize.
Let me go back to Professor Flavia Sicutini. In looking at these 13 trials that you studied as part of this meta-research, Were there any that were outliers here that showed that eating that skipping breakfast led to weight gain?
All of them tended to show that it wasn't a beneficial. It didn't have a beneficial effect, and the diets that were what was eaten wasn't varied across the breakfasts. And I think that the issue of healthy foods is important. But I think that when we really reflect on what is probably the biggest problem that many countries are facing, whether it be the US or Australia, it's not healthy eating, it's simply obesity. And I think there's a lot of focus on how healthy, healthy foods and how it's good to eat good food, etc. But I think that the elephant in the room is obesity, and the effects of obesity just trump everything. And obesity is, there are variations, as David said, in people's metabolism and so on. But fundamentally, we have to match our intake to what our bodies actually need. And the key about the breakfast story was that really adding, the breakfast skippers are ingesting less calories. And that is, that's probably the biggest message, that it's all about. And so even if a person decides to eat breakfast, that's fine, but you have to reduce the calories later in the day. And that's really where we're failing. And I think there's, and so, for example, I always remember someone saying, oh, look, it's really wonderful. I eat really healthily. I can't understand why, I only eat vegetarian. I eat all this healthy food. And someone pointed out that the gorillas in the zoo are vegetarian. And so I think it's really important to keep in mind that whatever else we do, whatever we put in our mind, it's about portion control and preventing obesity.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. That's Flavia Sicutini, Professor of Clinical Epidemiology at Melbourne's University of Monash, lead author in this study that looked at whether skipping breakfast posed a problem with gaining weight, and didn't found that breakfast had any protective effect when it came to weight gain. Dr. David Katz, founding director of the Yale University Prevention Research Center and author of The Truth About Food, Why Pandas Eat Bamboo and People Get Bamboozled. Good to have you with us. Stay tuned, Fresh Air. Terry Gross coming up next. Random House's copy chief, Benjamin Dreyer. They're going to have a lot of fun with grammar and usage of language coming up. Have a great day.